couple times. Mara Levert wrote a book about these ladies here and the tragedy that they had to go through. It's called The Boys in the Track. And I'm going to have her introduce these ladies here who are going to tell you quite the tale.
First, and on behalf of the Arkansas contingent, I would like to thank Chris in particular, but everybody else who has also been involved in putting this together. It is very good to be in LA. It's good to be able to talk to a conference like this. And I believe that great things happen from starts such as this. I am a reporter, and I became acquainted with the story that you're going to hear now as a while I was in the newsroom at the Arkansas Gazette. In 1987, word came into the newsroom that during the night, two boys had been found run over by a train in Saline County, the county just to the south, immediately adjoining Little Rock to the south. Of course, it was shocking and horrible, and it led to years of stories that followed and grew out of that one event. The two women who are with me are Linda Ives, who is the mother of one of the boys who was found murdered on that night, and Jean Duffy, who was a deputy prosecutor in that county. I would like to let Linda begin telling the story because it does begin with the horror that she experienced. Then Jean will carry on because she became involved with it as the story enlarged. And then I'll come back and kind of tell you some of what I was able to do as a reporter looking into it after that. So first of all, Linda Ives.
Thank you, Mara. You know, as I sat here and listened to the stories of the gentlemen that put this conference together today, I still feel very far away from that big picture and what is actually going on in our government. It just certainly was not my reality back in 1987, and you know, I'm still overwhelmed by the enormity of what has been going on right under our noses for years. Back in 1987, my husband and I had been married for about 20 years. We'd been high school sweethearts. He was a locomotive engineer with Union Pacific Railroad. We had kind of the perfect all-American family. We had two children, one girl and one boy. Our daughter Alicia was in Fayetteville at the University of Arkansas on scholarship. And Kevin was just getting ready to start his senior year of high school. And, you know, I look back on those days and, you know, I certainly see my life in two very distinct parts, before the murder and after the murder. And one of the things that has been very difficult for me to grasp and to do is to integrate those two lives. And in a heartbeat, what I thought I was living at the time, I certainly probably didn't appreciate it, but probably the American dream turned into a nightmare, an absolute nightmare overnight in a heartbeat. On that night, August 22nd, 1987, Kevin, who was 17, spent the night with a friend, Don Henry. And when he called that night, he and Don and some other friends had been out what they call cruising the springs, which is a local strip that all of the teenagers drove up and down and congregated on. The name of the street was Geyer Springs, and they just called it the Springs. And he called and asked permission to spend the night with Don. And I agreed to letting him stay, and I called Don's dad and told him that Kevin had called and asked to stay with him. He knew about the plan, and I told him to call me if for some reason they weren't in by 12 o'clock that night, which was Kevin's curfew time. And so that Sunday morning, when I got up, I was home alone. Larry was on his run that he makes between Poplar Bluff, Missouri, and North Little Rock, Arkansas. And around 10 a.m., the phone rang, and it was Don's dad. He said, "Linda, are Kevin and Don with you?" And I immediately was alarmed, and I said, "No, of course not. They're supposed to be with you." And he told me not to worry, that maybe they had gone to Don's sister's. And he told me that when they came in that night, about 12 o'clock, about 12:15 actually, they asked to go hunting, which in Arkansas apparently is done quite commonly. It's something we never would have allowed Kevin to do. But they went out to spotlight deer, which is shining a light in their eyes and making them easy prey, apparently. I, of course, was very upset and alarmed, although I assumed that they would turn up eventually and everything would be okay. I was very nervous and paced the house and called Don's house a number of times, and Curtis had been out looking for them. In fact, had gone to Don's sister's to see if they'd gone there. And shortly before noon, the phone rang, and Curtis said, "Linda, come quick. They've been shot and tied and run over by a train." And needless to say, that information just would not even process. I thought it was bizarre. I thought there was some kind of mistake. I didn't know what had happened, but that was just something I did not even consider as having happened. I called a friend to come over who did, and he took me to Don's house. And when I arrived there, there was a Saline County deputy there. And he assured me that there was absolutely no signs of foul play, that there were no signs that they'd been tied or shot, and that he couldn't even tell us whether or not that was actually Kevin and Don, but he could tell me that the description I gave him of Kevin's clothes matched that of one of the victims. I can't even articulate the feelings that I had. We really didn't know anything at that point. I just knew something bad had happened. I went home, notified my husband in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, to come home, called my daughter in Fayetteville. Friends put her on a plane and flew her in. And we began waiting to hear some word. We were told that the medical examiner's office would notify us if, in fact, it was the boys. We waited all day and all night without word. And I didn't know it at the time, but they hadn't even begun doing the autopsy until the following day. We made funeral arrangements as quickly as we could. This happened, the boys' bodies were found on Sunday. We made arrangements on Monday and buried Kevin on Tuesday. And I'll never forget when we went to make the funeral arrangements. And of course, I had never made arrangements for anybody at that time. And they took us into a room that was full of caskets, and I was just frozen, literally frozen to the spot. And finally, the funeral director came up to me, and he said, "Miss Ives, which one do you like?" And I told him I didn't like any of them. And you know, how do you pick out a casket for your child? We finally selected one with a baby blue satin liner, simply because that was the color of Kevin's 1981 Camaro. We began waiting then for the ruling on the manner of deaths. We began hearing all kinds of rumors from the community. It was a very small community of around 5,000. And needless to say, this was the topic that you heard discussed on TV, on radio, in the newspapers, and everything else. It sort of grabbed the imagination, I guess, of the media with the brutality of it. And we began hearing stories that paramedics had said that there was something wrong with the color of blood, that what little blood was present at the scene was very dark and tar-like, which led them to question how long the boys had been dead. We began hearing that the train crew had reported that the boys' bodies prior to impact of the train had been covered by a green tarp. We heard literally hundreds of stories, but we waited patiently, assuming that all of the answers to the questions that we had would soon be answered. And 3 weeks after the deaths, our state medical examiner, Fahmy Malik, ruled the deaths accidental. And one of the things that he told us, well, let me back up just a little bit. One of the things that Saline County Sheriff's Department had told us was that they had found traces of marijuana in the boys' blood system, and that they were looking for hard drugs. We were pretty indignant by that. They even told us that they expected to find hard drugs. And as any parent and feels that they know their child, I suppose, we told them that there would not be any hard drugs in Kevin's system, and asked him what would happen if they didn't find it. And he said, well, they'll probably rule it suicide. And with that, my husband picked one of the investigators up by his shirt collar and said, I'll tell you right now, we'll never accept a suicide ruling. So 3 weeks afterwards, when the ruling came down that it was accidental, we were stunned. The traces of marijuana that they had earlier told us about had suddenly become massive amounts of marijuana. And the medical examiner claimed that they had smoked 20 marijuana cigarettes, had fallen asleep on the tracks, and simply didn't hear the train. And which flew in the face of common sense as far as we were concerned. One of the things that we had learned from the train crew was that the boys had been lying in absolutely identical positions, side by side, soldier style, across the tracks, with a .22 rifle that belonged to Don laying between the two bodies. And, you know, my first question to him was, if they were so stoned out of their minds, why were they lying in accidental positions? Or, I'm sorry, lying in identical positions. And the response we got was about the effects of hashish on camels. And we were just totally dissatisfied with the ruling. And so the logical thing to us at that time was to get a second opinion. And we began trying to gather the various reports of the agencies that had responded to the scene that night, which were Saline County Sheriff's Office, Fire Department, Rescue Squad that had been there, a hospital paramedic crew that had been there, State Police, who had an officer on the scene. We began trying to get all of the various written reports that we could together, and try to get testable samples of the boys' tissue and blood. We located a second forensic pathologist out of state, or that was our intent when we began, but what we found was that these agencies were refusing to turn anything over to us. They refused to furnish any written reports. They told us there were no written reports because the boys were dead on the scene, and therefore that no written reports existed. That's what one of the hospitals told us, and told us that was the reason we hadn't been charged, was because there was no care rendered. We were told that we needed to get a court order for the samples of blood and tissue, which we did. We hired a private investigator, got an attorney, got court orders, presented them to the medical examiner's office, and he told us he didn't have to obey court orders. We were quite frustrated at that time, and after being stonewalled and hitting brick walls for weeks, trying to go through the proper channels, we were just absolutely livid. I called the Attorney General's office in Arkansas and was told that they could not force anybody to comply with a court order. So out of frustration with the situation, we called a press conference and invited local TV and the print newspapers to this press conference to tell them what we knew, what we had learned, and the lack of cooperation that we were receiving. And after that point in time, the medical examiner's office couldn't turn over things quickly enough to us. But one of the things that I think had been used against us during this whole process was a means of intimidation. The medical examiner pulled out a jar, put it on his desk, and poked it with a pencil and told my husband and Don's dad that that was part of the boys' hearts. They tried to show photographs that we had already told them we didn't want to see. They stonewalled us and tried to intimidate us at every turn. You know, as a parent of teenagers in Arkansas, I worried about a lot of things, and particularly about car wrecks, I suppose. But I can tell you, I never thought about anybody murdering my child. I certainly had no idea that our government was involved in drug trafficking and transporting drugs in the country, and I had no idea that drugs were literally raining from the skies in Arkansas. But the journey that we began at that point in time has led us in a lot of different directions. And there just are no words to articulate the feelings as a parent of a dead child that you have when you find out that your worst enemy is your government officials. We began hearing very early on that there were drug drops being made in the area that Kevin and Don were killed in. And probably the most popular theory at that time were that drugs were being dropped from trains. And that story seemed to come in 100 different various forms and fashions. And we knew very early on that there were local cops involved in the cover-up and in corruption locally. And after this press conference, we were absolutely ecstatic when a local deputy prosecutor came forward and told us that he wanted to help. He contacted us and set up a meeting in his office, and when we attended that meeting, there was another local attorney there named Dan Harmon. And they told us that they wanted to conduct a prosecutor's hearing, which was very much like a grand jury, except that it is in public rather than in secrecy. And so a prosecutor's hearing was held in February of 1988, and out of that four-day hearing, it was determined that there were enough questions to impanel a grand jury. Well, we were excited, to say the least, because the grand jury was calling the state police in on the investigation, and which is what we had been pushing for a long time. And so we thought, finally, we're going to get to the bottom of what's going on in Saline County and with our officials. The very first thing I heard about the state police investigation was from a friend who called and said, "Linda, you're not going to like this." Barney Phillips, the state police investigator who had been assigned to the case, is at the courthouse telling everybody he wants nothing to do with it. He doesn't want to step on toes of people he works with. So I called state police headquarters to complain, received a phone call from Barney Phillips shortly afterwards apologizing and assuring me over and over that he has no problem following leads wherever they went, whether it was to officials or wherever it went. He didn't mind stepping on anybody's toes. So with that rocky start there, we began the state police investigation. We were receiving numerous calls of people passing information to us, which we in turn forwarded to the state police. And periodically I would go to state police headquarters and try to find out what was going on with the case, what progress was being made. And what I would find was that whatever information had been passed to him had simply been placed in the file and no effort whatsoever to follow up on the information. This went on for months. Finally, my husband and I asked for a meeting with the head of the state police, who was Tommy Goodwin at the time, who was a governor appointed, served at the will of the governor. And I made him sit and go through 11 volumes of information that they had collected. And on these interviews that had been conducted, it would say so-and-so had said or done such-and-such. And then I would show him that nowhere in the file had it ever been followed up on. And I asked him if he would be satisfied if everything had been done that could be done if it was his child. And of course his answer was no. He couldn't defend our complaint that we had. And so he ordered the head of CID to put the case on computer and to generate a lead sheet. And that Barney Phillips, the investigator in charge of the case, should ask for help from other officers if he needed help following the leads. And about that time, my husband fell off the roof and broke both arms, so there was a long period of time there where I didn't go and check the file. But 18 months later, I did. And what I found was that there was a 9-page lead sheet, but they still hadn't followed any of the leads. There was nothing in the file to document anything that had been done in 18 months. And so it was very obvious at that time that the state police weren't interested in conducting a forthright investigation either. About that time, it became public through a newscast that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Little Rock was conducting a public corruption investigation in Saline County. And I began communicating with Bob Govar, and of course at first I was very upset because it turned out that the target of that U.S. Attorney's investigation was Dan Harmon and Richard Garrett, the two prosecutors who had, I thought, been trying to help us all this time. I knew the state police investigation was going nowhere, so and of course I had been receiving information about Dan Harmon for months and months and months, that he had been involved in trafficking, but he was very good at explaining it away to me. He had a very young wife and a new baby who was a drug user, and he claimed that the allegations against him were from people that he had put in jail and they were just out to get him. He was very, very charismatic and very persuasive in his denials of things that were being alleged publicly even by that time. But there was an incident that occurred, actually in the overall scheme of things, a very insignificant incident, where a young girl had attended a party and apparently had received some threats and left town. And I hunted this girl down and talked with her. And she really didn't even know anything significant or particular about Kevin and Don, didn't even know who they were. But the information that she had was that she had been at a party the night Kevin and Don were killed, and that Richard Garrett, the deputy prosecutor, had been there, and that there were drugs everywhere. There were teenagers and alcohol there. And of course, when he walked in, she was frightened and afraid that they were all fixing to be busted. But as it turns out, nothing happened. And so she said she could tell that there was an argument going on because of body language and that kind of thing. But I asked her, I didn't understand why she would feel threatened in any way. She had no information about Kevin and Don. And I asked her, I said, if you didn't know Kevin and Don and you were new to the area, how did you know who Richard Garrett was? And she said, he's married to my teacher at school. His picture sits on our desk. And so it became very difficult for me to explain away some of the information that I had. And I knew at that point in time that Dan Harmon and Richard Garrett were involved in drug activity of some type. And I went to Bob Govar, who was the U.S. attorney in charge of the public corruption investigation, and told him everything I knew, and began communicating regularly with him. And during this time, and over a period of probably 2 or 3 years that this went on, the federal investigation was in 1990, a number of witnesses began turning up dead. It was very alarming and very frightening to me. The 1990 investigation became my best hope, I suppose. I knew the state police weren't doing anything, the county wasn't going to do anything, and so I determined that there apparently was corruption within the state police and force as well. So I thought surely the federal investigation would get to the bottom of what was going on. Govar and I began communicating regularly, and one of the things that he told me was that indictments were imminent against Harmon and Garrett and others. And so, in fact, the words he used to me were "for the whole ball of wax." I didn't really understand what that meant at the time. But I put all of my hopes into this 1990 federal investigation. Suddenly, in June of 91, Chuck Banks, the U.S. attorney appointed by President Bush or Reagan, I'm not sure which, called a press conference and cleared Dan Harmon and Richard Garrett and all the other public officials in Saline County of everything. And I was stunned. I just was devastated. I didn't understand who had the power to shut down a federal investigation. And I didn't understand why Kevin and Don were so important. I had always assumed that it was just some local dirty cops involved, and that somewhere in the state of Arkansas was a public official in the position to do something about it. And also during 1990, there was a federal drug task force headed by Gene Duffy here that was going on, although I was totally unaware of it. And I'll let Gene tell you about that investigation. But after the 1991 shutdown of the federal investigation, we were just devastated. I mean, there was nowhere else to go. If you couldn't go to your local officials or to your state officials or even to the federal officials, where can you go? So about that time, a new sheriff was elected in Saline County, Arkansas, and we went to her and asked her to reopen an investigation, which she did. Put a fellow by the name of John Brown in charge of that investigation, which absolutely infuriated me. John was not from the area. He knew none of the players. By that time, we were years down the road, and I told Judy that it would take years for him to even figure out who was who and what was going on. So John went to work on the case, and he came across a witness who placed Dan Harmon on the tracks the night Kevin and Don were killed. And, you know, I had known for some time by that point that Dan was involved in a lot of things, and Dan and I had become very close. There wasn't a day that went by that I didn't talk to him three or four times a day, and I literally had assumed that he was the answer to our prayers and felt that he was doing his best to find out who had killed Kevin and Don. And, you know, for years, you know, the question had been who had killed Kevin and Don and why. And suddenly, with the shutdown of the federal investigation, the questions changed. As I said before, who had the power to shut down a federal investigation? Why were Kevin and Don so important? And in 1993, I was contacted by a young man who came forward, also placed Dan Harmon on the tracks. John Brown took him to the Little Rock office of the FBI, and he passed an FBI polygraph test to that effect. The earlier witness, Charlene Wilson, had been somewhat discredited, not somewhat discredited, had been totally discredited on a number of things. They tried to polygraph her on her information on the case, and the words to me were she couldn't even pass it on her name. So when the second witness came forward placing Harmon on the tracks and he was able to pass an FBI polygraph test, I was absolutely ecstatic because I thought we were near the end of the road in answering the questions about Kevin and Don. And suddenly the FBI ordered John Brown to turn over everything he had on the case, that they were going to take it over. He was ordered to turn over all evidence, all reports, all physical evidence. And at that point in time, I was very leery. I was very suspicious. I was angry because I thought that John was doing a good job. And I knew what had happened with the 1990 federal investigation. And I was worried that the FBI was going to sabotage the case or do whatever. I'm not sure how to articulate my worries, but I didn't trust them, I can tell you that, after I knew that they had lied and covered up things in Saline County. And so in 1993, the FBI took control of all of the physical evidence and the reports. So I called Al Finch, who I thought was the head of the FBI in Little Rock, and had a conversation with him, and he said, "Miss Ives, if you'll just sit back and be quiet and let us do our job, this case will be solved by the end of the year." And I told him that unfortunately I'd never had that luxury to sit back and wait on somebody to do their job. And I also told him that I had sat through a number of investigations that had been shut down whenever progress was made and links to public officials began occurring in those investigations. And I told him that if this investigation was shut down, I might have to sit by and watch it be shut down, but I wasn't going to sit quietly by this time. And they assigned an agent by the name of Phyllis Cornan to the case. Phyllis Cornan was in charge of doing the physical training tests for the FBI officers there in Little Rock, so I'm not even sure why she was assigned to the case, but she was. And Phyllis and I began communicating again, and Phyllis would share some information with me. One of the things that she told me that nobody was failing polygraph tests but cops. She also told me that this thing was bigger than she or I, and for me to be careful. I had found some things on Kevin's grave, one of which was a little plastic deputy's badge, deputy sheriff's badge, and a little plastic target man with all the body parts marked. And Phyllis confirmed a number of things to not only myself, but Jean, who began communicating with her. When I would call and talk with Phyllis, she would tell me that things were going very well. She told me that she was concerned that reports within the FBI would disappear and told me that she was keeping copies of everything herself in case they did disappear. She told me that she was concerned that the FBI would discount a female's judgment on things, that she had involved some other agents out of state. One was a polygrapher from Oklahoma. One was a fellow from the Quantico, and a behavioral, a behavioral psychologist that was involved in the case. And I don't remember just now what the third one was, but that they all three felt that she had a good case. And in November, actually Phyllis became pregnant. She married and became pregnant, went on maternity leave in the fall of 1995. And I could tell that things were slowing down. I could tell that Phyllis was very reluctant to talk to me. She wouldn't return calls. She wouldn't respond to any of my attempts to contact her. And so I called and asked for a meeting with the head of the FBI to get a status on the case. You know, I'd been told by Al Finch in 1993 that if I'd sit back and be quiet, the case would be solved by the end of 94, and it was now nearly the end of 95. And I could sense a distinct difference in the relationship with Phyllis. So a meeting was set up, and I was told with that meeting, who was with Bill Temple, the assistant agent in charge, that they had no evidence of anything. They didn't even have evidence that a crime had been committed. And it was time for my husband and I to accept that fact. And I asked about a knife that I knew that they had that had blood on it of some type. It had been tested in Little Rock and sent to Quantico to see if it was human blood. They told me there was nothing on the knife but rust. I asked them about the eyewitnesses, the one in particular who had passed a polygraph test. And I was told that they really didn't see anything. They heard voices, but they couldn't identify anybody. They totally dismantled any of the evidence that I was aware of. I can't even tell you what I was. I went home and cried for days. And by that time, Jean and I had met. We actually didn't meet until 1994. And Jean would call me and try to cheer me up, and we'd discuss what to do and where to go. And of course, there was nowhere to go and nothing to be done at that point. And so we had begun making a video through Integrity Films with Pat Matriciana, and it had been shelved at one point. And we decided to bring the video off of the shelf and finish the video and make good on my promise not to go away quietly this time. During all of these investigations, the links to me, there was a number of things, although no solid evidence. We received a phone call from an inmate, John Brown received a call from Russell Welch, who was the investigator in MENA, who had a audio of an inmate who said you needed to look at these connections between MENA and the boys' deaths. One of the things that Jean's investigation, in fact, I think the key piece of information that shut her task force down was the fact that the drugs were not coming from trains, but they were coming from planes. And I can't tell you the hopelessness and the feeling of complete lack of power to fight back against our government that we had. It defies any word in the English language to describe it. And recently, the latest development in the case has been a new FBI investigation that was opened just this past summer. And I believe that that investigation is intended to discredit Phyllis's investigation that I believe documented a lot of what we believe is true. And I think it's also intended to foil an FOI request that Mara has had in for several years. And I'll let Mara go into her FOI request. They first told her that there were no files on Kevin and Don's investigation through the FBI. And after she went through a great deal of effort, they've suddenly found 17,000 pages. And we believe it may be an effort to not have to release the files through FOI. But, you know, as I said, I sit here and listen to firsthand experiences of what's going on as far as our government is concerned, and I'm just overwhelmed by it. I can't even fathom. There are millions or thousands of Kevins out there that have been affected by this, and I just know that they may have stilled Kevin's heart, but they haven't quieted my voice, which is the only thing that I have left to fight with. And so I think that these conferences or meetings of the minds, sharing of information is all that we have, and that it's going to take the effort of a great many, many people around our country to make a difference and to make a change. And so as Mara said, I'm so grateful to these people who put this together and who have sacrificed personally and professionally in order to change things. Thank you.